Okay, we're in John, the Gospel of John in chapter 4. We're ready to begin with verse 19. John 4 and 19. So before we start this section, we remember we're studying about Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well. And as on his way to Galilee, he went through Samaria and he stopped at the little town of Sychar. And he stopped at Jacob's well, and he's having a conversation with the Samaritan woman. And it's a real good example of conversational evangelism. We're getting some really good lessons from the way Jesus is handling that situation. So we're going to continue. Remember, in the last lesson, Jesus had just revealed the woman's background and who she was and in life. And so with that revelation, we're going to be looking now at Jesus as he begins to teach her now what a true worshiper of God really is. If someone would read verses 19 through 26, please.
The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Father's worship on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshiper will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he."
Okay, thank you. Okay, you know, undoubtedly, when Jesus exposed this Samaritan woman's sin, she must have been shocked and embarrassed. But, you know, it's really a human characteristic when something like that happens to try to, number one, justify your sins or one sin, or number two, you try to change the subject. You don't want to talk about it anymore. So, but just notice, this woman does not deny what Jesus told her, because he'd ask her, go call for your husband, you know, bring your husband. And she answered back and she said, "I don't have a husband." And that was truthful. But she doesn't really want to talk about it any more than that, I don't think. So when Jesus revealed this about her, you know, I think she's trying to change the subject of the conversation. So, in verse 19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." Okay, so that's kind of changing the subject. But I think, you know, I think the words of Jesus at this point are getting to this woman. He's getting through to her and really stirring her wonderment and her amazement at this unique man. So she's knowing this is someone different. And I imagine that she's heard talk about the ancient prophets, although she said, and that's, I think, why she said, "Well, he must be one of the prophets." Now, in verse 20, he said, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain," or that's what the woman, this is still the woman talking in verse 20, "Our father worshipped on this mountain. And you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Well, I wonder why at this point is she interjecting this question about the proper place of worship. Why do you think she's doing that?
Probably because it was the hot topic amongst
the people. Yeah, and it was changing the subject too. It was taking the subject off of her, the conversation off of her. But it, you know, there's a couple of different opinions on why she may be saying that. She asked the question, one may be that she asked the question because she was interested and in hopes of that Jesus could provide some insight on the great controversy, because as Ben said, this was a controversy and it was current, one that they currently were talking about. And she worshiped on Mount Gerizim because our fathers did. And that's the way she put it. Now, how much she worshiped, we don't know. You know, but when we know that her lifestyle was one of being an adulterous woman, and so she was sort of out of favor even with her own Samaritans. But she's either saying that or she's trying to divert the attention from the embarrassing subject of her sins. But just think back or recall, when Jesus asked her to call her husband, she evaded the truth, but she said, "I have no husband." Well, that she said that was the truth. She didn't have a husband, but she was evading the real truth. And, of course, that was exposed. And so it appears that she's still trying to divert attention away from her sin. However, it's... Go ahead.
When she says our fathers worshipped on this mountain, what is she referring to?
Yeah, I think she's probably trying to go all the way back. They don't go back to Abraham. Usually they go back to Jacob. Because, see, this was the area of land that Jacob had purchased. And then when Joseph was buried there. And so that was kind of the basis of the Samaritans' religion. So I think she's talking about them. And I believe it was Mike that talked about, were we talking about in... back in Joshua, about them in Shechem, that they... it was last Wednesday night. It was, and they built a temple there. I mean, altar.
Yeah.
They built an altar there and worshipped on it, yeah. So all of that kind of together. She knew something about that when she asked that question. At this point, it's really rather difficult to determine if she was sincerely seeking the truth or not. But looking ahead in the story, I'm inclined to believe that she was really interested in at least becoming more sincere in her motives, at least. Now, in that first phrase of the 20th verse, it said, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain," and Bob already brought up that question. So she's probably referring to the building of the Samaritan temple, maybe, on Mount Gerizim, which they actually built a temple nearly 400 years before her time, before the time of Christ. So Northern Kingdom, those that were there, they did build a temple there on Mount Gerizim. But she could also be referring to the fact that Jacob built altars at Shechem, as we were talking about, and as we studied last Wednesday night, which were practically on the slopes of Mount Gerizim. So then the second phrase in verse 20, you Jews say that in Jerusalem is a place where you ought to worship. So, you know, I'm sure that the Jews were constantly reminding the Samaritans that the spiritual place of worship was in the temple at Jerusalem. And they were right about that. But I'm sure that when they talked with Samaritans, if they did even talk with them, they were constantly reminding them. But just consider, it has always been the rule of faith and practice for God's people that there is only one acceptable place of worship. Moses legislated that there was just to be one acceptable altar built. And we read that in Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter, and especially in verse 5. If somebody could turn there, Deuteronomy 12 and verse 5.
"You shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses. Out of all your tribes, you put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go."
Okay. And so they had one place, and that was at Jerusalem. But later the tribes that claimed land east of the Jordan River, which would be Gad and Reuben and Manasseh, at least part half of Manasseh, I think, they built their own altar. But they made it very plain when they did that, that they did not intend to erect an altar upon which to worship or to sacrifice. They said they were building the altar, and they recognized that the true altar of sacrifice was to be in Jerusalem, but they said that they were building an altar there, but they didn't intend to sacrifice on that. And we can read that in, well, maybe we did was that in Joshua, Eric, in the 22nd chapter, where did we talk about that just a little bit? There's several verses that point that out. We won't take time now to look at all of those, but there was discussion about, well, we're going to build an altar, but it's not going to be one that we offer sacrifices on. So if they built an altar, I don't know what they built it for exactly. Eric, did you study that any? Then still later, in the time of Hezekiah, Judah is reminded of one place to worship the Lord. Someone turn to 2 Kings, the 18th chapter, verse 22. 2 Kings 18, 22. Time of Hezekiah. Okay, that's just another point that God has always had one place to worship. And so, let's bring it down to today. What is the acceptable means of worship today? What's the basis or the place?
In the heart.
That's right, in the heart. We read that in 2 Timothy, the 2nd chapter, verse 22. It is in the heart. Okay, any other thoughts on verse 20? Okay, verse 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." So, I think beginning in this verse, Jesus is making an announcement of one of the grandest truths he revealed while he was here upon this earth. And he proclaims that the time is coming when it will not be a question of the proper place of worship, but it will be the proper way of worship. And so this whole idea of being God having only one place of worship in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, is God only has one way of worship. And only one way. So, This teaching, I think, is in reference to the promise that God, through Christ, will break down that middle wall of partition and abolish the enmity, even the commandment of the law of commandments contained in ordinances, and that all who seek to worship God may have access in one spirit unto the Father. And that's kind of just a very brief summary of God's way of worship that we are to follow. And then a little later, we're going to find in verse 23 that God emphasized this lesson, and I think probably he really emphasized it by the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. The temple was destroyed by the Romans, and I think there was a purpose for that. Okay, and 21. Any thoughts on 21? Or
I've got a note that I wrote down in my Bible from probably somebody I heard quote this or say this. But, what he's trying to get across is worship is a way of life and not something done at a special location.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
I think about
I'm glad you noticed that, because that I hope that is the main focus of this study, is to look, be watching how Christ handled these situations. Because, you know, he first brought it out very gently. He brought out the fact that she didn't have a husband. And, he said, in fact, the one you're living with now is not your husband, which indicated she was living in a sinful situation. So he established sin, but he didn't just pound her with that. But he put that in her mind. And then she thought, was saying, you know, I don't really want to talk about that anymore, but where we worship. So she started talking about the place of worship. Jesus, I think he followed her rabbit trail a little bit. But then he used that somewhere along the point. It's okay to follow a rabbit trail when they take off on something else, but as soon as you can find that point where you can bring it back around to what she needed, and she needed to know that the worship was going to be completely different now. And so that we're getting into coming up to that point of that living water that he told her that he could give to her. And she was really desiring that. So, you know, everything just, it works beautifully the way he brings this together. So I think it's a real good example of conversational evangelism, how to bring these things around and not put up blocks or red flags in front of people. So this teaching, as we said, it's kind of talking about the breaking down of the middle wall or partition. And that's actually what's going to happen. There's not going to be that wall of partition between the Jews and the Samaritans any longer. Okay, verse 22. Jesus continuing to answer her question. He said, "You worship what you do not know. We," speaking of himself and the Jews, "we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." So at this point, Jesus is reminding her that the Samaritan people are worshiping in ignorance. Now, some of it may not have been ignorance, some of it may have just been in rebellion, really understanding, but probably a lot of them at this point in time are actually ignorant of the, you know, the, of this. Well, doesn't that sound very familiar with a lot of situations today? I think people who are worshiping in ways that God has not prescribed are doing it in ignorance. Well, we're going to find out why that happens. Yes, go ahead.
I also think he's answering her question. Because she had asked, what's the appropriate place to worship? It
yes.
Basically says,
yeah.
He is staying on track with the point he wants to make. He does.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. He does. So, you know, we don't want to be guilty of when people we're talking to actually ask questions, and maybe they're a little bit off of the track, we need to try to answer those, but then all the time pulling it back in and to the truth that we're trying to teach to them. So, why did the Samaritans not know about the object of their worship? Why did they not know?
Well, because they were worshiping by traditions, maybe handed down by the fathers over many generations. I'm not sure, but it's easy to forget if you don't have, the truth.
And actually, we're told the Samaritans only believed in the first five books, the Pentateuch of the Old Testament. The rest of the Old Testament they rejected. They knew about it, no doubt, had heard about it, but they didn't accept it as authority. But, you know, I think the answer is kind of what Mike was saying, and it's the same as what Jesus told the Jews in Matthew, the 22nd chapter, and verse 29. And he said just very briefly, "Ye do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. So they didn't know the scriptures. If they had read all of the Old Testament, if they would have accepted that as authority, then knowing the scriptures is so key even with us. We have to know the scriptures. We have to know the New Testament.
But she did know that there was a Messiah coming, and that would have come through later books.
Yeah.
In the Old Testament.
It would have. I mean, you know, those books were, they were aware of them. But they had just kind of said, well, we're not going to go by that. You know, we're not going to let that be our guide. But then she brought that up. So they did.
I might not be remembering correct, but I thought Moses has a prophecy in Deuteronomy about the Messiah who is coming.
Anybody remember that? I don't call it right offhand. Do they do? No, he in Deuteronomy?
Yeah. There's okay. A prophecy in Genesis and a prophecy in
okay.
Deuteronomy, but it's true that there's not as much mm-hmm. in the first
prophet. Yeah. Yeah, it does. You know, in Genesis it does talk about the promise, but it's a little more obscure at that point. So on the other hand, the Jews recognized that God was to be worshipped in the temple at Jerusalem, but they had rewritten and corrupted the law to a certain extent. So they didn't really know the scriptures. That's what Jesus was telling them in Matthew 22 and 29. He said, you're in error because you don't know the scriptures. And since you don't know the scriptures, you don't know the power of God. And of all people, they should have known the power of God, considering everything that God had done for them. That was very powerful, but they didn't. And of course, that was in their past, but they hadn't accepted that. So as mentioned earlier, the Samaritans only recognized the first five books of the Old Testament as authoritative. But basically, they were holding on to the covenant of God with Abraham, but without the law of Moses and the prophets. They didn't want to consider the law of Moses and the prophets. I guess they were saying that's only for our neighbors to the south, the Jewish people, not for us. I don't know how they thought about that. So, how could the Samaritans know the prophetic promises concerning salvation of the Jews through God's suffering servant? Because we read about that over in the Psalms and in, you know, just how could they know of the devotion and the prophecies of the Psalms? Well, as some have already said, they had those books, no doubt, but they just weren't accepting them as being their guide. The salvation that comes exclusively through the Jews is clearly verified in most all of the prophetical books in the Old Testament. So they're all important just for them to study, and they're important for us to study today because they are a schoolmaster to bring us to the understanding more about Christ. Any other thoughts on verse 22?
Was it the worship of the Samaritan people kind of a mixed up deal with a lot of the Gentile idolatry, I guess?
Yeah. You know, as we went back, the history of the Samaritans were they were the northern kingdom of Israel that divided during the time right after Solomon died. And They immediately started worshiping up there and brought idolatry into their worship, and God was very upset with them. And then maybe, 200 years or 300 years later is when he allowed the Assyrians to come down and to conquer them. And the Assyrians' method was to remove most of the population country and transplant people from other places in there. So there was all these Gentiles coming in, mixing with a few of the Jews that were left. So that all got mixed up, and the Jews were able to bring in part of their old law, but they didn't accept it all. So yeah, it was really a kind of a mixed up mess, really. Okay, verse 23. But the hour is coming. This is Jesus continuing to speak. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. for the Father is such is seeking such to worship Him. You know, this verse really is linked with verse 21, where it was focused on the place of worship, while verse 23 now is focusing on the way of worship, the method of worship. And first of all, Jesus is not saying in this verse that at that very moment it was permissible to worship God anywhere. He really wasn't saying that, because in the first part of the verse 23, he said, "The hour is coming." But then he said, "And now is." So I think he uses that phrase because in his mind, the future is already completed. That is, he knows what is going to occur. And so from this time forward, the worship of forms or holy places will not be pleasing to the will of God. And so even at that time, that wasn't pleasing to God. Even when it was acceptable for them to do that, it really wasn't pleasing God. That wasn't what God was really wanting. He's really wanting the worship that comes about in the New Testament, that is, in the Spirit and the truth. Now, someone flip over to the 16th chapter of John and read verse 32. John 16:32.
"Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me."
Okay, so that's... He knows all of this stuff is going to happen. So also, Jesus is aware that in just a few short months, he will have fulfilled the law, and the veil of the temple will have been rent from top to bottom, as we read in Matthew the 27th chapter in verse 51, and that hour will have come when men will no longer be required to worship at one place. It's not going to be about place any longer. But just think about it. From that time on, spiritual worship can be offered in any land on the earth, any place, at any time, wherever the soul can humble itself before God, that's where worship can take place.
And in 13 he starts out with "but." So in the 22 he says salvation is of the Jews. But, so in other words, now things are getting ready to change.
That's right.
And he talks about the true worshipers. He doesn't say that it'll be open to the Gentiles there, but he's leading up to the fact that salvation will be for everyone.
For everyone, exactly, yeah. So it's just, you know, this Samaritan lady, this Samaritan woman is getting to hear things that even the Jews haven't heard yet. Think about that. Because the Jews had just, they've turned Jesus off. It's just, you know, we don't want anything to do with him. And it stays that way until they finally put him to death. They thought that'll shut him up. It didn't. Not just fulfilled what was written in the Old Testament. Okay, we don't have too much time, but let's go ahead and start on verse 24. We probably won't get finished with that. But God is Spirit. And this is Jesus' words. God is Spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. Now, I think this probably, it's important that it is very, it's important that we understand that what Jesus means by worshiping in spirit and in truth, because it has a very much to do with the way we worship today. That is what the way we are to worship. So, what has Jesus just told the woman? Let's just think back just a minute. He has told her, number one, that the time will soon come when the place of worship makes no difference. And then, number two, he told her that the Samaritans were in error by worshiping in opposition to the revealed truth. Not only were they worshiping in the wrong place, but their worship was based on untruth. They were not accepting the truth of God. So, therefore, to worship in spirit, I think, is to make it a matter of our heart. and our will and our spirit and the emotion, all of those things together, we need to make our worship part of that. And not just merely a matter of physical place or atmosphere that might be set up. And then that brings us to worshiping in truth. And that is simply to worship in accordance with the revealed will of God in the New Testament. And that's just putting it in very simple language. But that's what worshiping in spirit and in truth is. Now, some people will overemphasize one of these over the other. The spirit, worship in spirit, worship in truth. And this makes an unbalanced worship. And an unbalanced worship is wrong. It must be balanced between worshiping in spirit and in truth. In other words, you know, having an exuberant, joyful, loving spirit is great, but then following that and with a corrupted doctrine as the truth, it's wrong. It makes the whole thing wrong. Or, on the other hand, adhering to pure doctrine as a letter of the law, but without the spirit of a pure heart, is just as wrong. Either way you go, it's just as wrong. Acceptable worship must be in the right spirit based on the truth of God's will. And we need to keep in mind that any worship which is contrary to what is revealed in the New Testament is divisive and disobedient. So I think Jesus is actually telling the Samaritan woman, and not only her, he's telling all of us, that mere formalism is certainly an abomination unto the Lord.
So, when can we say that under the old law they were actually required to worship in the spirit and truth also? But I don't know if that was ever emphasized like it is in the New.
Yeah, I
never did like their empty sacrifices that they made. You know, the writing.
But you have to keep in mind, he gave them that law. So I don't think he condemned them for keeping what he told them to do back then. Even though he didn't like it, that wasn't what he desired. So I don't know, I don't think we could say that they worshiped in spirit and in truth. They worshiped maybe in truth to the old law. And I don't know if there was much spirit in their worship back then. It was mainly a worship because it was written down in the Ten Commandments, or it was written down in the Pentateuch. They worshiped, and that is what we're talking about when we talk about when you keep a law just because it has been written down, or just as a matter of a letter of the law. When you look at it just as a letter of the law, then I think we're going to have some problems with that.
So. Well, here's what I'm wondering about. Is he really referring, when we say the spirit of truth, when you become a Christian, you are given his spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The people under the old law, I don't know that we can say they were given any kind of spirit, except maybe the prophets may have been given some kind of
Yeah, that is a very big difference. They weren't given the gift of the Spirit like we are when we become Christians. Now they had, you know, God would give them spirit when he wanted them to act a certain way or to say a certain thing, but it's different.
Kind of the way I view this passage is what Bob had said earlier about true worship is a way of life. The spirit is how we are interacting with those around us and our way of life in reference to God. And the truth comes in, are we fulfilling the commandments that we're given through the Word?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of view it as the truth and spirit is, what is our, my wife calls it heartitude, as we deal with situations and people that come up in our lives, and are we using the Word?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. Well, our time is up, and you know, this is an interesting study, so we'll pick up on and kind of finish a few more remarks about the 24th verse when we have our class next Sunday. But thank you for your comments and your help. We'll take a short 5-minute intermission here.